you and I shared a love of the term Dare to be Dull, and that you were a columnist for CBS Money Watch. And as we're going to talk a little bit about, not specifically about buyouts, because you were not a federal expert, but people who are looking to retire this year or next year in the government, they're expecting a major surge of retirements. Many people will be lured out by a cash payment, a $25,000 buyout. That's $25,000 before deduction. So you're talking 16 to 18, depending on their tax bracket, their state, and whatnot. The problem is that there is a clogging in the pipeline of processing these retirement applications, these pension requests. And many people have been in it for as long as a year, and they've been, in some cases, extreme cases, they've only gotten 40% of what they're anticipating getting. So you're talking about leaving maybe to get a cash payment, and then you're going to have to go on half rations for 3, 4, 5, 6, even 12 months. And I know your most recent column, you were talking about 10 ways to save money. Is there a way we can sort of tie this in?
Sure. You know, the biggest factor of whether or not you can retire isn't the size of your nest egg. It's the amount that you spend in retirement. And there are all sorts of rules of thumb, and they can be very dangerous because you might find that you have a whole lot more time to travel, play golf, shop, and actually spend more.
Well, I know I just got back from a vacation, and I found that was that way. I couldn't get the money out of my pocket quick enough, and I was in Mexico City, which is not an expensive place, but even so, so it's not what you make, not what you have, it's what you spend.
Yeah, that's the biggest factor, how much you spend in retirement.
You said you don't do, did you say you don't do retail?
One of my mottos, which I don't always keep, but I try very hard, is never pay retail. Always try to buy things on sale. Always try to get a bargain.
And how do you do? I mean, do you actually go into a hotel and they say that'll be $110 a night, and you say no, it won't be?
No. I play. You know, some people like playing chess. You know, crossword puzzles. I like playing the game of travel. So, you know, I'll get on Hotwire, Priceline, and then there are bulletin boards that, you know, discuss what the actual hotel is. So I'll get on Hotwire, try to determine what the hotel is, you know, and then bid for a price. Or often then I'll go over to Priceline, and which is another bidding site, and, you know, bid a little bit less than what it was listed for at Hotwire to get very nice hotels for very low prices.
Now, are these the deals where they don't tell you where the hotel is? I mean, my fear is I'm going to San Francisco and I'm looking for the, you know, the Mark Hopkins or the St. Francis, but I wind up in Al's Motel in Oakland. How sure can you be what you're bidding on?
Well, number one, it's really easy to figure. It tells you what part of town the hotel is going to be on. And then, again, I go on sites called Bidding for Travel or BetterBidding.com, and people post what they've won and what the hotel is. So probably about 70 to 80% of the time, I know the exact hotel. But I've never had a disaster.
Okay. And what kind of savings do you realize when you do this?
Well, for instance, I just booked a hotel in the Scottsdale area. It's a 4-star hotel for about $62 a night, and I think the rack rate is about $150. So it's about a 60% savings.
That's worth doing the shopping. I was looking at your biography online, and one of the things it said, I believe, is that you want to never be compared to Jim Cramer. And he is the guy in shirt sleeves who, if you flip by on cable, you see him frantically telling people to buy this or do that. I must say I haven't watched it, but I've seen him in action, and that's not your style, huh?
I would say I'm the opposite. I did not say no. Lehman Brothers is not in trouble. You know, he's a great entertainer, and he has, you know, millions and millions of followers. But he thinks he knows what the market's going to do, and he thinks he knows what stock is going to go up or down. And part of being a great investor is accepting that we don't know.
Well, one of the most interesting investors I know is your son, who is now, I guess, about, what, fifth or sixth grade?
No, time goes on. He's 14 years old in eighth grade. Goes to high school next
Good
year.
Good Lord.
Taller than me.
Okay. Well, when I first became aware of him, he was a second grader who had written a book or was the subject of a book.
Yeah. The name of the book was How a Second Grader Beats Wall Street, because when he was 6, 7, 8 years old, I realized the lessons I was giving him on life were applicable to investing. And when money doesn't mean anything to you, it's simple to follow rules to, you know, buy more stocks to rebalance when the, you know, market's crashing, and then to sell to rebalance to get back to your target allocation when it's up. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Lots of just very simple rules that we all know, but as adult investors where money means too much to us, we keep making mistakes.
So the fear and greed thing that drives Wall Street, that's for real, huh?
Yeah, it is for real. And even if you look at the, you know, the best 401k in the country, which I still wish I had access to, the Thrift Savings Plan, you can look at where funds flow. When markets go down, people move out of the CS and I fund. And when markets go up, people move back in.
That's interesting that you mentioned the Thrift Savings Plan, because I know you've handled a lot of money and a lot of portfolios, and you said you would give anything to get in the Thrift Savings Plan, get your money in there because of the simplicity of it and the low administrative fees, and I guess the presence of the G Fund, the Government Securities Fund, huh?
Yeah, that's it. The low fees. I'm a very much of a believer in owning the entire market at the lowest fees, and you know I can do that through Vanguard, but federal employees can do it much cheaper through the Thrift Savings Plan.
I believe that Vanguard is one of the lowest fees in the business, and yet the TSP is half again what Vanguard charges. Alan, we need to take a short break here on Federal News Radio, but we'll be right back talking with Alan Roth from CBS Money Watch. Mike Causey here. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Alan Roth. He is a columnist for CBS's Money Watch and also director of Wealth Logic Limited Liability Corporation based in Colorado. And he knows the federal Thrift Savings Plan very well and wishes he could be in it. And it was interesting. Francis Rose and I, a couple of years back, interviewed John Bogle, who's a founder of the index funds and a founding father of Vanguard, and he said he wished he could be in the Thrift Savings Plan. So your message to federal and postal workers and military people is invest early and often, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you cannot save too much. Getting the power of inertia, putting money away for retirement is what's going to get you there.
Right. And Alan, your most recent column, and I think we keyed to it on our homepage this morning, but it said save money every day, 10 painless tricks. Can you run through those?
Yeah. Real quickly, you know, the first thing I do is every year I get into a ritual where I call the cable company and say I'm going to cancel, and they give me the teaser rate for yet another year. The second is I always find the best credit card. The credit card I use the most is a Fidelity American Express that gives me 2% cash back. Three, we talked about the travel and Hotwire and Priceline. Four would be I'm a big believer in coupons. You know, before my wife wants to go to a restaurant, I'll get online and Google the restaurant to see if there's any promo or coupon, which maybe says a lot about the types of restaurants I go to.
Mm-hmm.
Number five is the biggest is, you know, buy a modest car and keep it for a long time. That has a much bigger factor than the Starbucks, the $4 latte every year, every day of every year. I'm a big believer in shopping online. The ability to compare prices. Number seven is I'm a believer in knockoffs, not the fake Rolex, but I buy a laser printer, making sure that I can buy the cartridges from China for about 12% of the price that you'd pay in the U.S. Insurance, I'm a big believer in shopping for insurance. For the longest time, I had State Farm and paid a very large amount. The last two would be, number one, I complain if I'm not getting the service that I expected or the product doesn't work. I call and do it in a very smart way, taking down names and even contacting an officer of the company. And then 10, I keep cash working hard. You guys have the G Fund, which is a wonderful place to put cash within the Thrift Savings Plan, but you know, shop for online either savings accounts or CDs that have really easy early withdrawal penalties to stash my cash.
Alan, there are about roughly 4,000 people who are investors in the Thrift Savings Plan who are very vocal about wanting to have more options. They want more stocks to invest in. They want targeted narrow stocks such as a China fund or a gold fund, that kind of thing. And they also want to be able to trade a couple of times a day if necessary to time the market. And I know that's anathema to you. But I think one time you mentioned sort of a safety valve, and that was you set aside a certain amount of money. I may be misquoting you here, that's your mad money, and that's the money that you play with in investing. Is that true?
Yeah, I have my own little fund portfolio where I, you know, active trading for me is maybe buying two stocks a year.
Okay.
But there's nothing wrong with setting, let's say, 5% of your portfolio to have a little fun with, to exercise the part of your brain that wants to have some fun.
But almost universally, I guess you'll find out at the end of the year or the trading period that despite your very good hunches and whatnot, you probably didn't do as well as the more stable funds.
Well, you know, I think people will believe what they want to believe. So, you know, oftentimes if you do any benchmark, you remember the winners and forget the losers, and I'm no different. You know, oftentimes we'll compare against, let's say, the S&P 500 index, which is stripped of dividends and is only the 500 largest companies. So we're masters at convincing ourselves that we're brilliant.
Well, just everyone I know who goes to Las Vegas returns either as a winner or they break even, and that seems kind of unlikely given the overhead.
Yeah, they don't build the casinos to give money away.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, you know, I've asked people for a long time when they come back from Las Vegas, did they win money? And two-thirds of people say yes, and same thing is true for the market. Two-thirds of the people think that they're beating the market.
I know at the Washington Post at one point they let us take some of our money out of our 401k plan, which was Vanguard, by the way, wonderful one, and you know, do with it what we would. And a friend and I did that, and he set up a whiteboard, and we had sheets every day, and we were trying to figure out when we'd hit $1 million. Well, we never did. And at the end of the period, I think 2 or 3 year period, and this was the 90s when everything was going good, Vanguard had done much better than our fund. So thank you. Inertia is your friend. Thank you, Alan Ross, for being with us. Sorry for the technical glitch. We'll get you back on, and we'll be right back talking about the GSA situation. Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey talking with Alan Roth of Dare to Be Dull fame earlier in the show. And now we're going to switch over to retirements and, of course, the topic du jour, the GSA. And we have reporters, Federal Times reporters Andy Medici and Steve Losey on the line. Gentlemen, are you there?
We're here. How are you?
Okay. And Medici, I can't let that go. Are you one of them?
One of them. Uh-huh. I would think so, but there's no money in it, if that's what you're
asking. That's the problem. Okay, yeah. That's fame, but no fortune. Well, that's all right. Listen, delighted to have you both with us today. I've been on vacation for a week, so I missed out on the GSA. I got a piece of it coming back in, as we all done. But before we get into that, Steve, I know you've been tracking the retirement application backlog over at the Office of Personnel Management, and a lot of people are obviously planning to retire this year. They've put in their applications. We know they're going to put in their applications. And when the buyouts resume, probably in October, this could be a record banner year for people. What's the situation?
Well, the Office of Personnel Management has made a lot of progress since January, when John Barry said that he was really going to get serious about fixing this problem. Basically, in a nutshell, for years, when federal employees have retired, they have waited months and months. Sometimes some people wait for more than a year to get their full, complete pension. And in the meantime, they have to get by on an interim annuity that is often, sometimes half of what they're owed, sometimes less, sometimes more. And that makes it very tough for people who are on a fixed income to get by, to pay their mortgage. So John Barry has it's a problem that has kind of flummoxed a lot of OPM directors over the years. It's not just John Barry. But in January, he released a strategic plan that he said was going to fix it once and for all. and he's releasing stats every month, and we're keeping a close eye on these stats. And the latest numbers show that there might actually be some progress. The backlog was well over 61,000 back in January. It's now down to 52,000. That is a 14% drop since January. So, and the number of claims processed, they expected in March to have to process about 8,300 claims. They actually processed well more than 12,000 claims. So OPM is making some progress, and we are seeing some results. Now, the question is, the big question is, the number of retirements are spiking. We already saw a 24% increase in calendar year 2007 of retirements because people are wanting to leave because there's the pay freeze. There's all this talk about perhaps moving to a high five, perhaps increasing the amounts of money, that the amount of money they have to put towards their retirements. There's all these buyouts. So people are wanting to leave the federal government if they're able to. And those retirements, the pace of retirements is continuing to increase in 2012.
So the long-touted tsunami is upon us, right?
I don't know if I want to use the T word because that's been thrown around a lot over the years, but it is ticking up.
Well, it's interesting to me that, as you said, this problem has vexed every director of OPM. The difference is that John Barry is a lifer. He was on the Hill for many years. He was with Treasury. He was with Interior. He was with the director of the National Zoo, and now he's at OPM. So he knows the importance of this probably better than any OPM director, and knows the fact that just because you've retired doesn't mean you should be forgotten. So that's that bodes well, I think, for solving this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if we can get to the thing that the elephant in the room, the thing we cannot ignore, and that is the GSA situation. How did we find out about this?
Well, we found out the Inspector General for GSA, they released a report that detailed all of the spending. They were asked to do so a while ago just to investigate conference travel spending in general, and they came up with this. And they released it on a Monday the other week, and that same Monday you saw Administrator Martha Johnson resign, but not before firing Public Buildings Commissioner Bob Peck and her top advisor Stephen Leeds, and removing about four regional administrators from their jobs.
Now, that's the timing of that is interesting. I guess the IG had given them the courtesy of showing them this report before it was made public. And do you think that's what sort of set the stage for this ritual suicide?
Well, I think from what I've been told, they were given about a week, but they had known about this report in general for a bit longer than that. I think they were given that as Martha Johnson was given that chance as a courtesy, but also they're, from the IG's perspective, there's probably nothing wrong with releasing it during a congressional recess when people would be apt to pay more attention to it than they might otherwise have.
Okay, so, and I guess it's important to say, to sort of contain this, GSA is a small agency. Probably the average American does not know the GSA exists or what it does. And this is a small number of people within a small agency. We're talking about, what, 300 or so that were at this Western Regional Conference?
That's correct. Yeah, GSA, a lot of citizens, I think, got a little civics lesson today. GSA is normally described as the government's landlord and procurement agency.
Right.
And that is, in this case, it was on the public building side where they ran into this conference spending problem.
Now, this is, we've all seen things like this before. They've happened in defense. You had the tailhook scandal some years back with Navy scandal, if you want to use that term. So these kinds of things happen when people go away from their home base and relax. Things can get wild. But I don't ever recall anything with this dramatic. I mean, there's so many smoking guns in the room. Do you?
No, this is one of those situations where it was a sort of a perfect storm of factors came into play. You have dozens and dozens of examples of wasteful spending all rolled into one conference and all available in one little handy report. And each step along the way makes you ask, what were they thinking? And I think the outrage factor is pretty high when it comes to things like $6,000 for commemorative coins, $99 dinner per diems, $55 breakfast. Those are the sorts of things that catch people's attention. And the fact that GSA had been sort of risen to be the agency that's supposed to show how efficient government can be, especially under this administration, just sort of made the impact of this report all the stronger.
Now, when these people, a number of people, former Administrator Johnson and I guess her deputies, the ones that she fired, they have been called to testify on Capitol Hill, haven't they?
They've been called, or I guess maybe the proper term is invited. Now, whether they will show up, I still can't confirm, but these are one of those situations where it all depends on how Martha Johnson resigned and sort of what the inside situation was. So even though they were invited, they may or may not be at these hearings next week.
Now, it's an interesting situation, correct me if I'm wrong. Ms. Johnson and her two top aides, she resigned, she fired those two top people. But there are four careerists. Mike O'Connell here on Federal News Radio reported Monday that there are four senior career employees that are managers who were accused of violating acquisition laws and regulations. Now, they face the politicals, I guess, face embarrassment, but not necessarily criminal charges. But the career people, as I understand it, can face some criminal charges.
Yes, I talked to general counsel at a Project on Government Oversight, and, you know, contract laws exist for a reason, and they exist to sort of keep this kind of behavior in check. So there seems to be ample evidence. If the IG wanted to refer this case to the Justice Department, they could do that, but it would be up to sort of other agencies to pursue criminal charges against any GSA employees.
And would they be looking at, we're talking about contracting law, would they be looking at allegations that contractors maybe supplied some of this or wined and dined them, or is this just actions that were taken by government employees at the conference?
Well, I guess the phrase that we've heard a lot is that they wanted to make this conference over the top, and they did, and it seemed to be very much a sort of GSA manager spearheaded attempt. So when it comes to things like bribery and stuff, there hasn't been a lot of evidence of that. What there is evidence of is that they had a certain set of regulations that they had to follow when they awarded these contracts, and in many cases they did not.
Okay. Now, I know that being, we often don't think of this, but being called before a congressional committee can be a financial death sentence if they drag it out long enough. The GSA, I assume, is not going to defend any of these people, particularly the three that the one that resigned and the two that were fired. And the other individuals are called up. They have to do this with their own legal counsel, correct?
For the most part, yes. When it comes to things like, Dan Tangerlini, the new administrator, has said before that, you know, he does not condone these actions. GSA is going to look into it, and that, you know, this is something where they definitely don't support any of these actions. So separate legal counsel is probably something that they're going to look into. Of course, they don't have to. No one has to. But that's definitely something that they're going to have to look into if they do decide to testify before a committee.
Okay, let's take a short break here on Federal News Radio. We'll be right back talking about the GSA. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Andy Medici and Stephen Losey. They're reporters of the Federal Times, and they were there at the beginning when this GSA scandal broke a week or so ago. You both asked it, I've asked it, everyone is saying the same thing. What were they thinking? Do you have any insight as to how this happened?
Well, I mean, we said before that the managers at GSA, they wanted to make this event special, they wanted to make it over the top, and I think that as they were going, there were a few people who raised some red flags, but by and large, it was sort of an effort to celebrate their part of the agency, the public buildings, Western region, and it just sort of built and built, and there was a lot of steps along the way which they could have stopped, but they didn't, so, you know, call it what you will, maybe a team effort, but it was definitely a special conference.
Well, it seemed to me incredible, even in this day and age where everybody lets it all hang out on Facebook and whatnot, but to YouTube this, that couple of those video skits, and to me, the real crime was that they were supposed to be funny, but they weren't funny. I mean, there was nothing funny about it. It was just very heavy-handed and corny, and what are you hearing from your readers? I'll tell you, our people, as are yours, are mostly federal workers, their retirees, postal employees, or people in the federal family, contractors. And they seem to be, as Tom Timmons said this morning on his show, they seem to be doubly outraged because they're angry as taxpayers. They're furious with this kind of shenanigans. And they are humiliated, mortified, furious as government workers or former government workers who are having to relive this in public and take kidding from their friends and neighbors.
I think you hit on it exactly right. I mean, as you said, federal employees are angry as taxpayers, but they also recognize that it makes them look really, really bad. They're going to be all federal employees are being tarred by this GSA brush. I think you mentioned the videos. The first video that came out from Chairman Issa's subcommittee was a guy singing kind of a rap reggae song, and the tagline they put on it was American Idol, spelled IDLE.
Yeah,
and it kind of ties into the stereotype that federal employees, you know, don't produce a whole lot and, you know, spend most of their day kind of slacking around, goofing off. And, you know, you and I both know that for the vast majority of federal employees, that's not true. Most federal employees work really hard. But then when you go onto YouTube and there's, you know, federal employees being scary, bizarre clowns at GSA, it feeds into all those really negative stereotypes. And I think the acting administrator of GSA, the person who replaced Martha Johnson, Dan Tangerlini, he recognizes just how bad this is. He put out a video the other day on YouTube urging people, employees, if they haven't read the report, to read the report, and says those responsible violated rules of common sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's kind of just a spreading horror within the federal workplace that this, not just that this happened, but that it's going to keep staying in the news.
Well, I've been in some company situations, and I must say sometimes alcohol was a factor in these things, but where we all got together and started kidding and maybe lampooning and whatnot, and it really kind of got out of hand. And again, the cardinal sin for me is that the stuff wasn't funny. The things we were saying and getting yucks about really weren't that funny, and that was my impression with the GSA. It's as if they thought of everything they could possibly do wrong, and then they did it.
Yeah, and you know the one video I mentioned, the first video that got released, the most painful part of that is the guy raps about never going to be under an OIG investigation. And when you look at just the irony, just runs a mile deep.
Yeah, well, you know, for people who are not federal workers, maybe to walk a mile in the shoes of the vast majority who are innocent, and I say look at a well documented movie or a story about somebody in your profession who went awry. And I know I was at the Washington Post when the Janet Cook thing broke, where she faked a story and won the Pulitzer Prize, and we at the Post had to give it back. And there had been the case of Jason Blair, the New York Times guy. And most recently, there's a movie I commend to anybody in the news business. It's called Shattered Glass, and it's about a reporter for the
New Republic.
New Republic, yeah, right.
Great,
right,
it's
right,
a great movie. Yeah.
Well, and I don't know about you, but when I watch it as a professional, somebody in the business, I literally break out into a sweat and I cringe. And where other people might see something as amusing or funny or even bad, to me, it's a horror show. It's a nightmare come true. And I think if everybody could apply this GSA thing to their industry and realize that the vast majority of people in whatever we're doing are good people, but a few can bring it down.
That's right. Yeah. And as you say, when you watch these movies about corrupt journalists, and you know, you can imagine, you can see how people might, you know, miss something or overlook something, and it can very easily happen. And I imagine, you know, as Andy was saying, there were with this whole GSA thing, there were opportunities to stop, but I think some people, it was just kind of the culture, like, oh, that's, we're going to have a conference, let's, you know, make it a fun conference. And so, you know, was it $300,000 becomes $800,000, and it just spirals out of control.
And I thought, you know, my analogy was it's like going to Gomorrah to get lessons on how to behave in Sodom. Here you go to Las Vegas to have a conference telling you how to have a conference in a nearby town in Nevada, right below it.
That's where the Sunday school training kicks in, Mike.
Good deal.
I think it's also interesting to see that the GSA is trying to take steps. One of the things that they stopped the other day was a controversial awards program called the Hats Off program that was also troubled. It ended up losing more than 100 iPods, and there was criticism about who was getting these awards. And that's one of the things that Dan Tangerlini said, is that they're suspending this program pending a review, and you know it's very unclear whether that's going to come back at all.
Well, you know, a lot of government workers will say, and you see in the comments to these stories, they'll say this is nothing compared to what people do in the private sector. And I beg to differ. I don't know of any company, nowhere I've ever worked, where people are offered iPads or commemorative coins or anything like that. You get paid to do your job, and that's it. And I think sometimes the government is they're using this as a cop-out, that this is the way that private sector does it, or it's worse. Now, again, you have your examples like Enron of over the top, but most places don't do that. I suspect you don't do it at the Federal Times.
No, not at all. And you're right. I think it is a cop-out, and I don't think most private sector firms do it. But even if they did, that doesn't matter, because the government has to be held to a higher standard because it's running on our tax dollars. They have to be better than your Enrons, than your what have you, all the companies that run rampant. The government has to be better. And it seems like the people involved in this forgot that fundamental lesson.
Well, one thing that I noticed, I've gotten a couple of emails from people who said, if you think this is bad, and then they have started detailing what went on when they were with a particular agency. And I must say, none of them so far look as bad as this, but this is not the first time this has happened. Probably won't be the last, huh?
Well, definitely not. I think right now what you're going to see is Congress, you know, they are going to step in. Before, lots of the training travel legislation in which they were seeking to cut it hasn't gained a lot of traction, but you're going to see a lot more traction for legislation.
And the answer question there is, look who's talking. Hey, right. Andy and Steve, thank you so much for being with us. If you missed any of the show or you want to hear it again, we're archived on our homepage. Have a good week. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m.